Blog Talk Radio.
The Spirit of America Party and the Spirit of America Party book. Last night on the show, I made a mistake in doing the Arab translation of deceiving infidels by telling lies. And in the Muslim world, that is called taqiyya. I said it was takfir. But takfir is something different. Takfir is when one Muslim accuses another Muslim of apostasy. But, like the Democrats, Muslims believe that if you tell a lie to promote your religion, in the case of the Democrats, they have no religion, so that's communism, they use the word taqiyya, which means that it's not a sin to tell a lie. And that's what the Democrats believe. So I thought I'd get that off my chest. I do have a list of words if you want to learn a few, improve your vocabulary. I was going to start this at the first of the year, and I never got around to it. But we'll do one tonight. It's called ab initio, A-B space initio, ab initio, and it means from the beginning. So we could say the Democrats lie ab initio. And then we have another word, and it's called graupel. And graupel is granular snow pellets, also called a soft hail. So now you can tell, and it's a Germanic in origin. It's the diminutive of graupe, meaning peeled grain. According to etymologists, there does seem to be a grain of truth in the assumption that the word grew from the Slavic word krupa, which has the same meaning as graupel, which was first seen in 1889 in a weather report when they predicted the global warming after the town froze and died. Yeah, funny. Zillionaire, this one you might like. Zillionaire, we all like to be zillionaires. Zillionaires, and you heard about the couple that was walking on their land outside of San Francisco, and they found gold coins, $20 gold pieces, made in USA, baby. And they, you know what they were in? They were in, like, empty paint cans. Now, that means they never walked their land with a metal detector. Because had they walked their land with a metal detector, chances are they would have picked up the metal cans. But it doesn't matter because they picked up 1,200 gold, $20 a pieces, which at the time in the 1840s, they were worth $20 a piece, which would have been a total investment of $2,800. And it turns out it's now worth $10 million. Now, this is the funny part. They're going to be allowed to keep it. Well, who made that rule? Huh? You don't think there's some town ordinance or some mayor or some governor that's looking over their shoulder right now saying, let's check the books and the records and see if there were any holdups? Yeah? You know that. Wait till you see. Let's see if these people get away scot-free and are allowed to keep the whole $10 million. Yeah. I know some foreign countries won't let you do it. The word millionaire has been used in English to designate a person who is worth £1 million or dollars, depending on the side of the ocean, since 1826. We borrowed the word from the French, whose millions, of course, were in francs. How do you keep them from going bad? And when millionaire and no longer a sophist, English speakers coined the billionaire in 1860. The term of the century apparently brought a turn of fortune, for soon afterwards multimillionaire and multibillionaire were created. But by the 1940s, we needed zillionaire. So it's a good thing we had coined zillion for an indeterminately large number the previous decade. Zillion and zillionaire are used in the most formal of writing, but they have found their way, aren't used in the most formal of writing, but they have found their way into plenty of serious publications. Zillionaire. And that's what you're going to have to be to pay your taxes. We'll give you two more words and then we'll go to a tune and then we'll set up to do the show. I may talk about General McChrystal. I like this guy. Gamble. To skip about in play, frisk and frolic. When President Clinton was in the Oval Office, he used to gamble a lot. He used to frolic. And here's the other word, phlegm, P-H-L-E-G-M. Thick mucus is secreted in abnormal quantity, especially in the nose and throat. The remarkable phlegm with which he faced his many adversities left us wondering whether he was a stoic or simply apathetic. They must be describing a Democrat. Phlegm, ancient Greek physician Hippocrates theorized that human, I wonder what Hippocrates believed life began, were controlled by four humors: blood, dominant in cheerful, optimistic types; black bile, which rendered a soul gloomy and melancholy; yellow bile, a source of irritable, angry attitudes; and phlegm, ruling cool, unemotional types. When the Greeks related these humors to the four elements, air, earth, fire, and water, phlegm was linked to water. But from an etymological standpoint, the word phlegm is more closely linked to fire. It comes from the Greek word that means flame or inflammation. Yellow bile, that's what the Democrats suffer from, irritable, angry attitudes, especially when they burn the flag and kill children. Did I say that? Oh, my God, what's wrong with you, Tom? You're supposed to be brainwashed. You're not supposed to talk like that. In my younger days, I played this to go to sleep. Like rivulets of cool drops of water. Cal Jader on Vibes, is some of the best music I ever heard performed by Cal Jader on Vibes was with George Shearing on piano. And, man, it was sweet. And I was privileged once to go to a Latin jazz show at Hunter College many, many moons ago. And all the greats were there assembled in one night, never to be duplicated ever again. Some of them died a year or two after. But what an ensemble was there that night. It took me about a month to come down from the musical high. It was really great. So we're looking at General McChrystal. And I'll give you a little point of information. Somebody came back to me. I plugged McChrystal for president. And one of the blog sites that I put McChrystal for president on, someone came back to me and they said, let me see if I can tell you, I wrote it down. They said he's a social political liberal. Well, you're going to have to tell me more than that to convince me of that. And if he is, I still welcome him as presidential material, because you don't serve in the U.S. military for 26 years, write letters to mothers of dead GIs, fly in the face of your combat enemies at night in a helicopter, like I read you yesterday in a UE, and lead an entire military force in the country of Afghanistan. And if he's a social liberal, that's okay by me. I'll take social liberals like him every day of the week. So here's chapter two. Last night we covered his thoughts on Christmas and all the Christmases he missed serving his country, and as do other guys. This guy, to me, is a private's a general. When I saw that one photo of a private saluting him, and rather than him playing big general, he reached out his hand like he had just met a long-lost friend. That was all I needed to see, especially when I see Obama bin Laden getting off a helicopter and flipping the bird to the Marine that's holding a salute. Yeah, he gives him the brush. Yeah. We'll pass on that commander-in-chief. Journey to the plane, July 72 to June 76. I was raised to respect soldiers, leaders, and heroes. They were who I wanted to be. They were why I was there. And in the unblinking sunlight of an August morning at the United States Military Academy in 1972, the colonel in front of me looked like the embodiment of all I admired. Hanging on his spare frame, his pine green uniform was covered with patches, badges, and campaign ribbons. Even the weathered lines of his face seemed to reflect all he had done and all he was. It was the look I had seen before on my father's face. You know, his father was a colonel and got four silver stars. And his father, he looks like Mr. Military. Hanging on, I said that already, let me see. Even the weather, I saw that. For a moment, I could envision my father in combat in Korea, or as the lean warrior embracing my mother as he came home from Vietnam. He was a lifelong hero. From my earlier memories, I wanted to be like him. I'd always wanted to be a soldier. Yet the colonel's words were not what I wanted and expected to hear. As he stood in front of me and my fellow new cadets, he talked about collar stays, the 25-cent pieces of wire cadets used to secure the collars of the blue-gray shirts we would wear to class during the academic year. As he spoke, we tried not to squirm under the sun. Our backs were arched, arms flat to our sides, elbows slightly bent, fingers curled into tight palms, chests out, chins forward, eyes ahead, mouths shut. I was 5 weeks, you should try this on a school bus. I was 5 weeks into my education at West Point. We were still in Beast Barracks, or simply Beast, the initial 8-week indoctrination and basic training phase during the summer before the fall term of our freshman year, plebe year, in West Point's time-worn terminology. There were not many full colonels at West Point, so it was rare for cadets, particularly new cadets like us, to interact with them. It seemed like the extraordinary opportunity to hear from a man who had done so much, but he wasn't discussing his experiences and the truths that had yielded. He was talking about collar stays. "Gentlemen," he said, "soon you will begin to wear the class shirt. You will wear it every day of the academic year and per uniform regulation. You will secure your collar with the collar stays that have been issued to you. It may seem insignificant to you now," he continued, "but you're here learning attention to detail." For the next few minutes, the combat seasoned colonel compared neglecting to wear collar stays with forgetting ammunition for our soldiers in combat. Focusing on even the small things, he reasoned, develops a leader who never neglects the critical ones. I thought it was stupid. Collar stays were for your collar. Ammunition mattered. And although we were not yet officers, we knew the difference. The soldiers I had grown up admiring were Sam Grant in his dirty private's coat and Matt Ridgway and his hand grenades. They wore mud-covered or sand-dusted fatigues, not collar stays. In that moment, the colorful block of campaign badges on the colonel's left breast seemed less like proof of his having fought in wars being waged far beyond the academy's granite walls, and more like ornaments that flashed as he paced and pivoted. One of the things I can't stand to see now is to see these officers all wearing their medals. They look like heroes of the Soviet Union. I'm a ribbon guy. I like ribbons. So, following the rules here would make me a good cadet, but that was not my goal. I wanted to be a combat leader. And in the colonel's soliloquy, I could not see a connection between the two. What I could not have foreseen then were lessons of unconventional leadership I would learn during my 4 years in the most conventional of places. Weeks earlier, on the night of Sunday, July the 2nd, I didn't sleep much. The next morning, I was to report to West Point to begin my training as a cadet. A friend had driven with me from Northern Virginia to drop me off. At a motel a few miles from the academy, we sat outside sharing cans of cold beer from the small cooler, talking late into the summer night. We talked often about my desire to be a soldier, rarely about what that really meant. I'd likely be a soldier for the rest of my life. I was prepared to tread a well-worn path. Cadets that have been entering West Point since 1802 and 140 years later, 6 months after Pearl Harbor, my father had done the same, graduating in 1945 as a member of one of the abbreviated 3-year wartime classes. He went on to fight in Korea and Nam and was a major general. As I prepared to enter 30 years after he first reported as a cadet. But he never pushed me to apply and was supportive but hands-off as I prepared my application. I attributed his stance to the fact that one of my older brothers had attended and then quit West Point a year earlier. I suspected my father worried that he had pressured my brother to go, but he also sensed I was different. I always assumed I would attend West Point, but had never thought much about what it would be like to be a cadet. From my birth to an Army captain and his wife, I had been an Army brat. After that, West Point seemed the natural route. There was not much more to the decision. I never fixated on the school itself, never dreamed of wearing cadet dress gray. I arrived at the academy already looking past it, eager to get to the real soldiering that came only afterward. The next morning, my friend and I drove through the Academy's gates and followed the drive that runs along the edge of the cliffs overlooking the Hudson, until it breaks away from the river and veers up a hill to Michie Stadium, where Army's football team plays. It was warm and I was nervous. At the stadium, we found swarms of people. This was reception day, known as R Day, and 1,378 new cadets had shown up to be officially received into the academy. From the stadium, we were bused to a series of concrete courtyards walled off by barracks that cadets called the area, a desolate stretch that I would come to know intimately. That morning, it was controlled chaos. From the perspective of a new cadet, as we were called until the end of Beast Barracks, upperclassmen ran the show. Postured like sentries in gray trousers and starch white shirts, they clenched their jaws and pulled their hat brims low over stern eyes. They controlled our every movement. Through decades of practice, our day processes neared a scientific precision. The circuit ensured that all new cadets that day could be sworn in, stripped of outside possessions, supplied with new ones, measured, weighed, outfitted, sheared, scared, and finally paraded in front of their families in a matter of hours. For the Academy, it was an impressive feat. Families saw the often shaggy high school graduates they deposited earlier that morning reappear as uniformed, disciplined soldiers. For some parents and siblings, it probably felt like a miracle. For new cadets, it felt more like being rats in a maze, directed through the process by an upperclassman known as the man in the red sash, who tracked our progress on cards, a safety pin to our shorts. We felt like fools, outfitted in T-shirts and knee-high black socks and black dress shoes. We looked like fools as well, but it was efficient. Before arriving, I expected the hazing and knew to address the older cadets in formulaic, yes, sirs, and no, sirs. But I had always regarded West Point as an inconvenient but necessary hurdle I had to jump to be a soldier. But I had always regarded West Point as an inconvenient but necessary hurdle to jump to be a soldier. By the middle of my first day, the obstacle appeared gigantic, 4 years like an eternity. Of the nearly 1,400 who stood at the point of land overlooking the Hudson River that evening, more than a third would not graduate. 180 would leave before the summer was over. Some admitted cadets had quit that first day. But more than 30 of these newly born plebes, including Ray Odierno, David Rodriguez, Bill Caldwell, David Barno, Frank Icarni, Frank Helmick, Mike Barbero, and Guy Swan, would serve as general officers in turbulent times for our Army and nation. Earlier that day, we had eaten our first meal in cavernous Washington Hall, the cadet dining facility, as we had every other meal before. That evening, we ate our second meal, and we would eat every meal thereafter, and by their rules, seated family-style at a table 410. Two upperclassmen ruled eight new cadets, controlling what and how we ate, correctly reciting plebe knowledge we were all required to memorize, might yield a rushed bite or more, depending on how hard-ass our elders decided to be. Knowing Schofield's definition of discipline, which ironically counsels that the discipline which makes the soldiers of a free country reliable in battle is not to be gained by harsh or tyrannical treatment, might allow a cadet a quick forkful of potatoes before the minder ordered the utensil placed back on the table. Routinely, we left plates of untouched foods at the end of meals, or food became a fixation. After dinner on the first night, we retired to our rooms. Am I boring you? You think, should I continue? Where our M14 rifles and other equipment had been placed on bunks before we arrived. I don't remember exactly what I thought as our first day ended. Much of what I had seen that day seemed silly. But the ubiquitous tablets containing names of graduates who had fallen in battle did not. Many of the soldiers I admired for their battlefield leadership had begun where I was now, had navigated the same peculiar process, and had emerged with qualities I sought to emulate. Had this seemingly absurd process molded them? After a long, often disorienting a day, it was too much to ponder. When we finally fell into our bunks to sleep, I think I took comfort in the fact that no matter how long I stayed in the Army, I never have to have another first day as a soldier. That's the same for privates as it is for officers. Every guy remembers his first day in the military. After Beast Barracks, we settled into life as plebes, like the peas on our plate during Beast. The minutes of the day throughout the academic year were not ours to consume freely. We necessarily became efficient. Reveille was at 6:15 hours, and we arrived at formation 10 minutes later in complete cadet uniform, clean and shaved. There were no wasted movements in those early minutes, especially in winter. Before entering the mess hall for breakfast, all 4,000 cadets stood in formation outside the barracks, and the chain of command inspected our uniforms. The fife and drum corps accompanied every movement to and in from a formation. The rest of the day was spent at class with 40 minutes for lunch. On autumn and spring afternoons, we either paraded for visitors or played sports before rushing back to the barracks to clean up, don our dress gray uniforms, and report to formation. And then the band fifed and drummed us back into the mess hall for dinner. After dinner was time for study before taps ended the day at 2300. That's 11 o'clock. When all rooms went dark, some studious cadets covered their windows with blankets to hide the light or requested official permission to continue studying, known as late nights. I never much did that. I had a slow start academically, and for the first 2 years, poor grades were a lurking threat to my cadet career. The subjects which are dearest to the examiners, Winston Churchill once wrote, were almost invariably those I fancied least. The same was true for me during plebe and yearling years when the curriculum was loaded with math and science requirements. The system of daily recitation and grading begun under the early 19th century superintendence of Sylvanus Thayer, known as the father of the academy, was bad news for a poorly prepared student like me. In math class each day, including Saturday, we stood at the blackboard in front of a new problem that tested the previous night's lesson and briefed the solution to the class and the instructor. I got crushed in math and over the first 2 years fared poorly in chalkboard battles with chemistry, physics, thermodynamics, and engineering. When I could, I retreated from my math and science textbooks to histories and biographies. Compared with Grant's account of Shiloh in his memoirs, attempting to prove mathematical theorems and calculus was unbearable. Normally focused on daily requirements, West Point in 1972 felt estranged from the society it was meant to serve. A decade of fighting in Vietnam and a series of scandals like My Lai had degraded the military's credibility with the country, and as cadets we were periodically reminded that we were out of step with the views, values, and lifestyles of many of our generation. The communists were working then, my friend. They were working. There was a bigger communist movement in this country than in Vietnam. On Saturday, October the 21st, we traveled to New Brunswick, New Jersey for the Rutgers football game. We then were bused into Manhattan and allowed our first few hours of freedom since our day, but required to remain dressed in our distinctive gray uniforms, Walking near Times Square, a friend and I heard a loud, long honk and looked up to see a forearm and middle finger poking out through a half-open window of a passing car. As visible symbols, soldiers often receive praise or condemnation, and both reactions felt curiously undeserved. Yet the gap between us and American society was palpable and disturbing. Cadets were not alone in feeling alienated. At the end of his tenure as a superintendent of West Point in 1974, General William A. Knowlton invoked the Academy's historical role as an 18th century fort when explaining to his successor that as superintendent he had spent 4 years defending a stockade surrounded by attacking Indians. West Point was training officers for an army that had lost its moral footing in the eyes of the country. No, you didn't. The eyes of the country were distorted, and they were fed with propaganda and lies by the communists. West Point was training officers for an army that lost its moral footing in the eyes of the country, and it was commissioned officers into the army that valued the ideals as graduates infused into the force, but also thought some of those graduates were prima donnas and spoiled brats. In the words of Army Chief of Staff General Creighton Abrams, who had overseen the drawdown in Vietnam, if West Point felt like a penal colony, the feeling forged the close bonds among cadets. My roommate for the second detail in the winter, we rotated rooms and roommates 3 times a year, and one of my best friends for 4 years was Arthur Ken Leipold. It was hard to miss Kenny, and I noticed him early during Beast Barracks. He was an offensive tackle with an expansive frame, kind eyes, and dimples that appeared when he smiled and laughed, which he did a lot. Like most people, I was drawn to Kenny because he did not take anything or anyone at West Point too seriously and did not suffer kindly those who did. His legendary devotion to friends, easygoing charisma, and disarming humor were antidotes to the rigor and pomp of West Point. Another friend I met early was Rick Bifoco. Stocky and quick, Bifoco was a star lacrosse player from Long Island, but was built like a boxer from Brooklyn. He excelled in math and engineering, but he had a wickedly quick wit and a mischievous streak. Success in academics and athletics came easily to Rick, but from the beginning it was clear he valued the intangibles of camaraderie more than anything else. Rick, Kenny, and I became an unlikely but close a trio for all 4 years. All three of us were on hand for the historic mess hall rally turned riot on November 3, 1972, the night before the Army football team played Air Force at Mitchie Stadium. Pep rallies in the mess hall, in spite of the slight damage they caused, were an unofficial tradition and one of the few outlets for the cadets. But thus far, that year, the Academy leadership had ordered the celebrations to be subdued to the frustration of the Corps. That afternoon, however, the Commandant, Brigadier General Philip Fear, had filtered a message down through the companies to all cadets. The Commandant had determined that damage to the mess hall is of a secondary importance to the morale of the Corps. The implication could not have been clearer, and the effect was electric. We entered the mess hall and took our places as usual. The mess hall, with 100-foot ceilings, stone arches, and light filtering through stained glass windows, normally felt like a church. Portraits of stern soldiers of yore lined the walls, peering down at cadets who sat with their respective companies. There were 8 companies seated during Beast, then 36 companies divided into 4 regiments when we joined the rest of the Corps at the start of the plebe year. Laid out like an asterisk with 6 wings converging in the center, the mess hall was where General MacArthur, near the end of his life, bade adieu to the Corps, the Corps, the Corps, in his famous 1962 address to cadets. The wall at the end of the northwest wing was a massive mural from 1936, a Bayeux tapestry-like panorama of 20 decisive battles. After a few months, the massive wood doors swung. A few moments, the massive wood doors swung open, and an army jeep, laden with members of the Pep Squad, yelling into cone megaphones and pumping their fists, crept slowly down the aisle between the tables. Trailing the jeep, the Academy's brass band streamed through the door in double file, playing the Army fight song. The hall echoed with the sounds of horns and drums and the loud gurgling of the engine. The jeep veered left toward my company and B Company of 1st Regiment, which sat at the foot of the mural. As it passed, the cadet from my table took a water pitcher, ran up to the jeep, and dumped it on one of the rabble-rousers, soaking him and igniting mayhem. By the time the jeep completed a U-turn at the end of our wing and came rumbling back down the gauntlet toward the center, a huge layer cake had been smeared across the windshield. At that point, it was all over. Okay, I'm going to take a break. I'm going to play a tune. When I come back, we'll read the rest of General McChrystal's time in West Point. Hang in there. Open milk cartons and heaps of mashed potatoes, dinner rolls, butter, handfuls of salt. I hurled cups of ice cream, pulling off the tabs and lobbing them like grenades. Across the hall, through the clouds of projectiles, cadets stacked dining tables into a multi-story tower and climbed to the top. The steely marching band played on, a bit like the quartet on the deck of the Titanic, providing a booming soundtrack to the whole scene. And when the din settled and the cadets had launched their last missiles, the walls and the dark oil paintings had been streaked with food. In the glorious mess, two things were clear. First, the Corps had never felt more like a brotherhood. The next day, we dramatically upset Air Force. The second, fear, normally considered an old guard, Martinet, had displayed uncommon leadership. Most will remember that on that day he understood that he led young men, not hollow gray uniforms. If West Point was hard, I made it harder. During Beast, I recorded my first slug, slang for the Academy's punishment following an infraction. In that case, it was for disapprobation towards a cadet superior. After an upperclassman berated a fellow cadet and me, he took a shortcut through a building to cut us off as we were walking away, catching us laughing at his reprimand. Depending on severity, slugs earned some combination of demerits, room confinement, or hours marching on the area. At the end of Beast Barracks, I reported to the regular cadet company I would be part of for the next 4 years, with the uncommon and dubious distinction of a negative disciplinary mark already on my record. My second slug was more serious. Before spring finals, a girl I had been seeing scored Kenny and me some alcohol, and we drank it in our barracks room, a violation of regulations. What started as a surreptitious sips of vodka mixed with Right Rock soda evolved into two idiots playing air guitar to increasingly loud music. I'm not sure it was a social drinking, but it was fun, and I cherish it as a special memory of Kenny. Of course, it ended badly. The next morning, one of our tactical officers, an Army captain, found me in the basement showers of our barracks. Friends later told me that I tried unsuccessfully to hoist myself up off the cold tile by grabbing at the stunned officer's pants like a rope. I don't remember. 2 weeks later, a commandant's board issued my punishment, 41 demerits, 66 hours walking the area, and 3 months of room confinement. Punishment of cadets has been artfully crafted. In the early 19th century, West Point officials deemed manual labor an inappropriate punishment for a cadet. It would have been an ungentlemanly task for a future officer, but they could make him do something that was tiring, embarrassing, and most excruciating, accomplishing nothing. So, cadets ever since have been awarded area tours, which represent an hour, 2 hours on a Friday afternoon, and three on Saturday, walking in our dress gray uniforms with rifles across the area. As my bemused father explained to me, the area does not make you smarter, braver, or more expert. Even trench digging would offer some tangible benefit. At the academy where we hoarded free minutes, walking the yard meant wasted hours. While I ran afoul of certain academy rules, I had respect for the tradition of honor embedded in the institution. My slugs were for infractions of West Point regulations, the same rules that govern how much rust was acceptable on a rifle, or how our rooms were to be made and kept immaculate. The cadet honor corps was entirely different, and there was a clear, bright line dividing shenanigans from transgressions against integrity. Failing to clean your barrack sink was a violation of the regulations and earned demerits. Lying to anyone about whether you had cleaned your sink was a violation of your honor, and it meant expulsion. When it was chartered in 1802, the Academy adopted the unofficial code of honor that covered all levels of officer conduct in a regular army. Infractions of the code were settled between cadets, usually in a formal fistfight. Eventually, the scope of the code narrowed, but the underlying aim remained the same. The code existed to ensure that the words of cadets and officers alike would always in all situations be taken as truth. Lies, even small ones, had threatened that system of trust. The decision about military honor was particularly fraught when I was a cadet. It was the twilight of the Vietnam War. The Army was broken and sought to heal itself. The scandals of the war, particularly falsified body counts, had sent fissures through the officer corps, and West Point was severely shaken. Although I was probably more aware of these issues because of my father, it was obvious even to the cadets at West Point that the Army had wounds that would take a long time to heal. The massacre of South Vietnamese civilians at My Lai in 1968 and the subsequent cover-up had exemplified the challenge that had reached into the academy a few years before I arrived. When then Major General Samuel Costa was superintendent, a West Point veteran of World War II and Korea, Costa had commanded the 23rd Infantry Division, troops from which had perpetrated My Lai. In March 1970, the Pierce Commission recommended he be criminally charged for his part in the cover-up, and he was forced to leave the academy. Before he left, he famously warned the assembled Corps of Cadets, "Don't let the bastards grind you down." Beyond Costa, other graduates were implicated in a myriad scandals of Vietnam. Although accounting for only one-tenth of the officer corps in 1976, West Pointers were meant to catalyze honor and discipline in the rest of the Army, but in the eyes of many, they had fallen short on the mission. During my time there, I struggled to repair the damage. Progress was made there and across the Army, but shortly before I graduated in June 76, the Academy was rocked by the largest scandal in history. More than 100 cadets in the Coward Junior class 1 year behind mine, including members of the Honor Committee, faced expulsion for colluding on an electrical engineering exam. The scandal spurred national media attention and congressional hearings. If Honor could not be safe at West Point, what chance did it stand in the nation as a whole? When I arrived, the code had been distilled into a simple directive. A cadet will not lie, cheat, or steal, nor tolerate those who do. Cadet leadership added the last part, the toleration clause. Only in 1970, but it had existed for many years in the self-policing spirit of the Corps. If the code's basic word became simpler over time, its enforcement did not. In the late 19th century, cadets elected a vigilance committee to police honor violations and field accusations. When a cadet was found guilty of an honor violation, the committee made sure he left the academy. Eventually, the committee became an advisory body without explicit punitive powers, although the commandant almost always expelled a cadet whom the committee found to have violated the code. Now, you take a look at McChrystal when he was called before Obama bin Laden, and if you see any photos of him, he is standing there, and he is an honorable man. And whatever he has to do to make things right, he's going to do it. The other guy, he doesn't. It's all about him. When I arrived, and we did that already. Okay. In the rare case when the committee's recommendation was not followed, the Corps summary justice took over. A year before I arrived, the Honor Committee had found cadet James Pelosi guilty of cheating. Pelosi's lawyer got him reinstated on a technicality, so the Corps began to treat him as if he did not exist by silencing him. No one spoke to him. He had no roommates. He ate alone at a separate table. reportedly plebes in charge of delivering laundry threw his in the dumpster. Being in a different company, I never knew Pelosi, but I recognized how precarious it was to allow vigilantism among 18 and 19-year-olds. The Corps saw that as well and banned silencing in 1973. Yeah, that's a rough course to run. While honor was sacrosanct to me, other academy regulations were not. On the afternoon of October 27th, a Saturday, 1973, one day after I finished the sentence for my May slug, I screwed up again, this time drinking in my room with a classmate and friend, Rick Bowman. Rick and I would go on to serve together in the 82nd Airborne as lieutenants, and then for many years in special operations, where he flew in and ultimately commanded the elite 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment. But that was later, and for now we were just fools in trouble again. When I appeared before the Commandant's board 2 weeks later, the colonel in charge, after hearing the details of my infraction, took off his glasses, paused, and shook his head. "Okay, you've got to explain this to me. You just finished the slug," he said, tapping my files, "and here you are about to eat another one. Explain that to me." I had no explanation, but I was glad to hear him asking me for one. It meant I wasn't going to be thrown out. The colonel could do the math and knew that if he wanted to, he could make the slug big enough to put me over the limit in demerits. I did not offer any excuses and simply explained that I had shown poor judgment. He agreed, 44 hours on the area. Despite all my behavioral nonsense, my peers evaluated me well. My tactical officer expressed disappointment in my poor decision-making, but never wrote me off. Some classmates jokingly compared me to Captain Virgil Hiltz, the character played by Steve McQueen in The Great Escape, the 1963 film about Allied soldiers in a German prisoner of war camp during World War II, an irreverent, carefree inmate. Hiltz is known as the Cooler King because he spends his time trying to escape or being punished for it in the cooler, solitary confinement, when he plans the next attempt. The comparison was a good-natured honor, sort of. My fourth and final slug solidified this reputation. After dinner one evening near the end of our yearling year, I joined Kenny Leipold, Rick Bifoco, Rick Bowman, and a few others in barracks horseplay with unloaded vintage weapons from the West Point's museum. Being yearlings with more energy than sense, we were soon chasing one another down the hallway, clicking the triggers, yelling bang, bang. It was literally sophomoric. We soon spilled out the back door and ran to the entrance of Grant Hall a few yards behind our barracks. At that time, Grant Hall served as a place where upperclassmen were allowed to congregate and meet dates. Inside a long, very West Point-like lounge, dimly lit and filled with overstuffed leather furniture, we achieved complete surprise running through the door, mimicking the rat-a-tat of the guns, tossing socks at perturbed upperclassmen and their dates, doing combat roles at their feet, laughing wildly, and then we withdrew to our barracks rooms. As we caught our breath, the flashing lights lit up the walls and the ceiling of our room from the street below. We looked out the window to see a military police car. Suddenly our door opened and a tactical officer entered the hallway, behind him full of faces trying to catch a glimpse of the fugitives. "Was it you?" he asked. "Yes, sir," we responded. "You got the weapons?" We handed them over. Disappointed, the crowd in the hallway dispersed. He closed the door behind him and turned to us, one barely concealing the amusement. "What were you knuckleheads thinking?" In the end, he wrote up the event conservatively, and we received a light punishment. But I finished the year having walked 127 hours on the area. I'm going to take a break. We'll give you another tune. Hang in there. Is it too much reading? Does it
Does it ruin your day or what? Let's see what we got here. I've got something that, okay, here we go.
I've always lived by this golden rule. Whatever happens, don't blow your cool. You gotta have nerves of steel and never show folks how you honestly feel. I've lived my whole life this way. For example, take yesterday. I breezed home happy, bringing her my pay. Her note read, "So long, sappy, I have run away." I threw myself down across our empty bed, and this is what I said. So I went for the roadie at an all-night bar. Wound up so loaded I tore up my car. The judge threw the book at me, and when I read his sentence, there I said, I said, she's the only one I have to thank, and I found her and pulled my gun and fired point blank. The shot whistled right straight past that woman's head and killed my hound dog dead. Say, be cool, stay cool, stay cool, keep cool, cool.
You ever feel like that? Okay, so we continue with General McChrystal. When I entered West Point, some Americans still believed the Vietnam War might end honorably. By the time I graduated, South Vietnam did not exist. As cadets, we watched the war teeter and implode, and the historical sweep was not lost on us. My interest in Indochina began when my father first deployed to Vietnam in 1965 as part of President Lyndon Johnson's escalation of the war that summer. Then a lieutenant colonel, my father commanded the 2nd Battalion of the 18th Infantry Regiment, part of General William Depew's 1st Infantry Division, the Big Red One. Their battalion ran search-and-destroy missions in the Ben Ho area in South Vietnam near the Cambodian border. Curious about what my dad was doing, I read The Two Vietnams by Bernard Fall, the war correspondent and historian who chronicled the French and later American experiences in Indochina. Only 11 at the time, I struggled through parts of it, but from then I was always captivated by Indochina, and eventually read all of Hall's books. The focus of my senior year in high school was a research project on Indochina, Ho Chi Minh, General Giap, Jean Lelattre de Tassigny, Bruno Bigeard, and the other players in the conflict fascinated me. Their outsized personalities and human flaws all converged in the military and political fights of the First Indochina War. The essay ended up well over 100 pages long. It was not groundbreaking, but I had pursued the topic with an intense curiosity about how the French had failed so spectacularly in their efforts to maintain their colonies and why the Americans and the British had decided against overt intervention in those early years. While I studied the French War, support for the American one evaporated. Growing up near Washington, D.C., my friends and I went to peace demonstrations in the Capitol, curious to see the events. I remained supportive of the war but was skeptical of the American war strategy. The echoes of the French defeat culminating in the disaster at Dien Bien Phu stuck with me. The war that the United States fought in Vietnam was different from that waged by the French paratroopers, for better and worse. As much as the French tried to dress it differently, theirs was a war of empire, and their counterinsurgency was built on untenable colonial foundations. I didn't think America's was. When I was a junior high school, my father deployed for a second tour involving bitter fighting in the Central Highlands alongside our Montagnard allies. Beginning with the Tet Offensive, the upheaval of 1968, explosive civil rights and anti-war protests, the murder of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, Nixon's election, My Lai, was seared into my young mind. At home, I watched my mother endure another separation for a war I strongly suspected she opposed. Mary Gardner Bright was a beautiful Southern girl with no connection to the military who had met and fallen in love with a young lieutenant. It wasn't an easy life, but she navigated six children through two wars with that. Even as a 14-year-old boy, I recognized was stoic courage. From the first day of Beast, it was unlikely that Vietnam would be our war. In the years before we arrived at the academy, the Nixon administration had steadily drawn down troops, a policy widely supported by the American public. By the time I reported to the man in the red sash, there were fewer than 70,000 American troops in Vietnam, down from more than a half a million only 3 years earlier. A half a million, and you got the president with only a half a million to protect the entire nation. Nixon, like the rest of America, wanted out. Throughout 1972, the combatants waged bloody campaigns on a peninsula to shore up their negotiating positions that fall in Paris. In October of our plebe year, we watched National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger return from Paris to announce peace is at hand. But negotiations stalled that autumn and broke apart in mid-December. That winter, Nixon ordered an intense bombing campaign. On January 27, 1973, North Vietnam signed peace accords with South Vietnam and the United States in Paris, formally ending what at the time was our nation's longest war. In April 1975, the Corps watched intently from within the walls of West Point as Saigon fell. We followed world events to the degree we had time. But we were first and foremost college students. I never knew who among the cadets were conservatives or liberals. We did not walk down the halls deep in heated discussions about Vietnam or anything else. We were at the academy during the doldrums of the early 1970s, too late to have been ignited by President Kennedy's idealism, and too soon to be bolstered by Reagan's confidence. Our president was Nixon, and he resigned in shame over Watergate in August 1974. Shortly after Nixon resigned, I returned to West Point for summer training and leave. I had a good summer experience at Airborne School at Fort Benning, Georgia, where I became qualified as a paratrooper after making five jumps, and then Fort Hood, Texas, with a Ranger unit, and I felt a little bit closer to being a real soldier. But at the time, I did not know how central being a paratrooper and Ranger would be to my life. I returned to West Point more focused, but I was carrying baggage. After four slugs and still on the book to serve the punishment for the last,
With a weak academic record, my future was anything but secure. The implications of my performance in my first 2 years have been made clear the previous spring, when I had tried to take the first step toward what I considered serious soldiering and volunteered to be one of the few cadets allowed to attend Ranger School during the summer break. I was disappointed when I was turned down because of my low academic, disciplinary, and physical training scores. It was a wake-up call. Soon after returning to the start of Cal Year, I met my new tactical officer, then Major David J. Barato, who had graduated from West Point in 64, completed 2 tours in Nam, earning a Purple Heart and a Bronze Star, serving in Special Forces. He was aware, competent, and tough, but never petty. The young tactical officers who arrived at West Point in those years responded to the institution in different ways. Some, even those with combat experience in Nam, internalized the spit-and-polished culture of the institution. Others were disgusted that preparing cadets for war meant inspecting the underwear in the bureau drawers. To them, the academy was, to use a West Point phrase, choosing the easy wrong, not the hard right. While I was there, dozens of young officers quit their academy posts. Major Barato had scheduled counseling sessions with every cadet under his command. Until that point, my interactions with tactical officers had generally been positive, but also perfunctory. I was not in handcuffs when I met the Barato, but I had earned a reputation. At that time, I was still walking punishment hours for drinking and for raiding Grant Hall the previous spring. I braced for a lukewarm assessment. I expected counseling for my poor infractions and advice that only if I focused more could I succeed at West Point. I got your file here. You have a lot of potential and talent, and you're going to be a great cadet, Barato said in his soft-spoken manner. I see you as having a serious leadership position at the academy and as being a great Army officer. I was stunned, he continued. I see a lot of potential in your peer ratings, and I think you're going to do really, really well. His words were not empty cheerleading. My personnel file included write-ups of my infractions, but also my peer ratings. At West Point, the cadet's class rank was an amalgam of various scores and evaluations. The quarterly peer ratings on leadership were weighted heavily. In this area, the other members in B1 ranked me at the top of the company. So while what Barato said was based on my record, he had chosen to focus on aspects he considered relevant and important, not on my antics. Barato knew that I was West Point as a means to an end and that I was anxious to finish. He held that the academy was a fine place, but more than anything, he addressed me as an officer to be, not as a cadet, who needed to be lectured on collar stays. At every point in my career, I saw people live up or down to expectations, and Barato skillfully lifted mine that afternoon. This is pretty good, right? You're getting a good background on how this guy thinks, okay, and what his history is. It's sure different from a community organizer who plays the race card, huh? Barato knew that I saw West Point as a means to an end. I had returned that fall ready to be serious, and a number of factors, beginning with the confidence of Major Barato, led my performance as a cadet to surge. I was a bit older, I was tired of being slugged, and I'd learned from my rejection for Ranger School that my poor performance carried costs. Shenanigans ended. I matched my professional drive with personal focus. Many of my fellow cadets had come to West Point with girlfriends, but often, if a cadet served plebe year, the relationship did not. I had arrived at the academy with plans to remain a bachelor to go it alone. Annie Corcoran had changed all that. I first met her at Fort Hood in Texas during winter break in 73. Our fathers both served there, and we met at a Christmas party organized in the neighborhood. Annie was beautiful, grounded, strong, and quietly but ferociously independent. Like me, she came from a military family. Her father, Colonel Edward Corcoran, had served in Korea as a lieutenant In August 1950, from the Pusan perimeter, he had led his tank platoon far into and back out of North Korea in the war's bloodiest year. Later, he had served a tour in Vietnam. And he understood what it meant today to marry a soldier and decided not to. But we connected, and she accepted my invitation to visit West Point from her college in Pennsylvania twice that spring. When I went to Fort Hood that summer to serve for a month with a Ranger unit, Annie was a lifeguard in a pool near my bachelor officer's quarters. I courted her aggressively, and by the end of the summer, we were dating seriously. And I, who had planned to be a hard-bitten warrior, was in love. When Annie wasn't visiting, I often stayed in my room reading biographies and histories, a passion that I inherited from my mother, a woman of extraordinary energy. When she read, my mother bore into a book and would have to be shaken to look up from the page. Throughout my childhood, she passed me Tennyson, biographies of T.E. Lawrence and John Paul Jones, Greek and Roman mythologies, tales of Scottish chiefs, and stories of Roland at the Pass and Horatius at the Bridge. My mother was raised on these stories and on Scots-Irish stoicism, so that when my father deployed to Vietnam, she not only held down the fort, she made it hum. If she was afraid for her husband, her strength would not allow her to show it. Instead, she changed her world. When Mary started a garden, it became an industrial-size operation. When she engaged in liberal politics in Arlington, she dragged me with her to stand in front of the local supermarket and hand out balloons and flyers calling for better education in the country. My mother was special. On New Year's morning in 1971, when I was a junior in high school, my mother woke me up feeling sick. Although they'd not celebrated the night before, my father, a new Brigadier General, took her to the Army clinic at Fort Myer. She was swiftly moved to the hospital. By midnight, she was dreadfully ill, and a few hours later, wow, in the early morning of January 2nd, she passed away. It was a shock to the family and to my father especially. We all missed her deeply. But the impact her loss had on the stoic soldier I loved and admired was tragically evident. Part of my mother's legacy to me, my affinity for history and literature, pulled me through my final 2 years at West Point. Among those military biographies I consumed, Grant's memoirs seeped into my pores most deeply. The last 2 years wore away more rapidly than the first two. Grant wrote of his attitude toward the academy, but they seemed about five times as long as Ohio years to me. So it was for me, Cal and Firsty years featured more English and history courses, and these played to my strengths. History 381, Revolutionary Warfare, was my favorite. It was one of the few classes that focused on small wars and unconventional warfare at the academy, otherwise stuck in a World War II era mentality. We studied the insurgencies, the counterinsurgencies in Malaya, Algeria, and Greece, all of which I found fascinating. I studied figures like Lawrence and conflicts like Indochina that seemed to carry lessons relevant to being a soldier in the kind of wars I expected to fight. Beginning in the fall of Firsty year, my general order of merit began to matter. It would determine which branch we joined and our first assignment. By that time, my grades had improved over the prior three semesters, and the academy began to weigh more heavily our military performance, where I scored well. Branch selection was dramatic, with my entire class seated in Thayer Hall Auditorium. Starting at the top of the class, each cadet stood and announced his pick. Engineering, field or air defense, artillery, armor, intelligence, signals, or infantry. Each choice reduced the remaining slots available. As slots in other branches ran out, the lowest 100 or so cadets that year were ranked into infantry by default. I had a choice, however, and went infantry. My grandfather, father, and older brother had all worn the crossed rifle insignia of infantry officers, and I never considered any other option. As graduation neared, the gears of my life turned smoothly. Annie agreed to marry me. I excelled academically, and because of my meteoric leap in a class rank after graduation, I would be able to join the storied 82nd Airborne Division. Obama's cutting that, right? I had expected, I think he's taking one-third. He's reducing it by one-third. I excelled academically, and because of my meteoric leap in class rank after graduation, I would be high enough to join the 82nd Airborne. So Annie had been studying German in anticipation of going there, but the chance to be its paratrooper and serve in one of the units most likely to be involved in any potential conflict made it an easy decision. On Wednesday, 1976, June the 2nd, I graduated, and my father commissioned me as a second lieutenant. Our graduation ceremony was where we begun our cadet experience at Michi Stadium. And as I sat with 834 other members of my class out of an original 1,378 waiting to receive our diplomas, I realized that I was very different from the 17-year-old boy whose friend had dropped him off 4 years earlier. I wondered if I could or would be the kind of military leader I admired, and I was eager to try. When the ceremony ended, in accordance with tradition, we launched our hats in the air and congratulated one another. I rapidly looked for Annie and the exit as soon as possible. I threw everything I owned into a used Chevy Vega I'd bought and set course with Annie down the hill away from the campus. As we neared the last bend before the academy gates, I turned to her and, "Hey, look back at West Point." "Why?" she said, twisting in her seat. "Because that's the last time we'll ever see it." And so that ends chapter 2. And you can see everything that this man is was taken away from him by a handful of politicians who played petty for. But still, he was man enough to accept it. So God bless Lieutenant McChrystal. And goddamn, Joe Bite Me. So we're going to close with a tune. Let's see what we can close with. We can close with, ooh, that's a heavy one. And we did it on Eagle's Wings last night. We can't do 4 minutes. Oh, we'll do a light fare. Somebody Stole My Gal.
Somebody stole my gal. Somebody stole my pal. Somebody came and took her away. She didn't even say she was leaving. Her kisses I miss so. He's getting them, I know. Oh, gee, I know that she would come to me if she could see that a broken-hearted lonesome pal. Somebody stole my gal. Da 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 Oh, gee, I know that she would come to me if you could see. There's a broken heart and don't jump out. Somebody stole my girl. Somebody stole my girl.